Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 7th of January, Anno Domini 2012. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
We're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff to choose, things to use, nothing to lose at 12:02s. Here we go.
Starting off the new year.
Might as well do it right.
Right, you know, not even skipping a beat, dude.
And for all of those of you who were waiting for me to get the year wrong, not yet. Wait till, like, March.
That's an adjustment.
For the first few weeks, it's fine, but then after that, you forget.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's where I'm luckily going to quicken. I don't have to fill out, you know, the date. You know, usually always in the check registry. Yep. It's the first place you mess things up.
Although it is annoying, the last couple of receipts you enter from last year, it assumes this year, so you have to put the year in for that.
Yeah. Right.
True.
Right.
True.
All right, in fact, if you're listening, I need a receipt binder for this year. I always forget to get one before the year starts, and now the receipts are piling up.
Right. A new version of the SpyEye Trojan Horse software not only steals your money, it then offers false reassurance that it's still there. When you visit your online bank, there will be no trace of the transactions that cyber criminals are using to empty your bank account. Worse, your balance will also be adjusted on screen so that it looks as if nothing happened. The software, which steals your bank passwords to give access to your account, waits for you to enter the same banking details before adjusting what you see. The idea is that it gives thieves more time to use your debit card details on fraudulent transactions without you realizing it's happening. The first you'll learn of the attack is your bank refusing your money or a paper statement showing that your cyber criminals have been draining money out of your account. The new version of SpyEye has targeted banks in the U.S. and the U.K. and has already been detected on Windows PCs in both places. Trusteer, a security company which detected the attack, says the next time the victim visits their online banking site, the malware hides the fraudulent transactions as well as artificially changing the total balance. As a result, the deceived customer has no idea their account has been taken over or any fraudulent transactions have taken place. SpyEye is a tweak of the Zeus crimeware kit that grabs web form data within browsers, said Naked Security blog at web security experts Sophos. This year, right before the recent holiday season, Trusteer found a hopped-up version of iSpy attacking banks in the U.S. and the U.K. It's an amazing piece of software. While what it does is reprehensible, the way it does it is incredibly clever. Like I said, what it does is you go to your bank, and you get infected, and it doesn't do anything until you go to your bank. Then it steals all the information from your bank, you know, your username, your password. Once it's in, it can get everything else, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And once it's done that, now it starts buying stuff off of your credit card, but it remembers what it bought. So when you go to your bank website again, mm-hmm. and bring up your transaction, it actually hides all the transactions that it made and adjusts your final balance so that you don't know anything happened.
That's really sophisticated.
That's incredibly sophisticated. Yeah. So our question to you, are you worried about the SpyEye Trojan? And the choices are, nope, I don't bank online. Nope, I don't use a PC. Nope, I'm not that bright. And, yep, I'm taking precautions. So far, we have 38 votes, and I'm happy to say that the majority of you are taking precautions.
Do you know what the propagation vector is?
Huge, what apparently, right now.
So it pops up all kinds of things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's popping up in all kinds of places. The thing is, it doesn't do anything to your machine until you go to your bank. So it doesn't make the machine slow down, and it doesn't pop anything up to ask you for money. It doesn't do any of that stuff.
It's got a claim to be something to get into your PC. You know, Windows update, Flash update, all the typical stuff you usually see. Yeah,
it's coming on everything. So here's the deal. Once you have voted at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, I know you will have more you want to say about the SpyEye Trojan. So check the yellow box underneath. Click on Give Us Your Opinion. It will take you to a truly magnificent website. where you can enter your opinion. When you're done with that, come on back and listen to us for the rest of the show. And by the way, are you worried about the Spy Eye Trojan? Give us a call. It's 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Even if you just want to talk about how very clever this virus is, because
that
it
is.
Really is clever. It's an amazing piece of software, I have to say.
Well, like I told you, that other one that we've been battling with right now is that ZeroNet.
Right.
It's a rootkit. And we're still working on trying to find a solution, short of backing up the data and, you know, pulling the hard drive out, wiping the machine, back up the data, and then start with a fresh install.
Yep.
Right now, it is so insidious. Ready to pull out hair. And sorry, I'm losing it enough naturally. I don't need to be pulling it out.
Yep. Yep. And today, of course, is the 100th birthday of the Addams Family cartoon.
Really?
And if you go to the Google website, today's Google Doodle is all about them.
Well, it's 100th birthday of Charlie Addams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or was it the cartoon, too?
No, it's the cartoon, according to these people.
Charles Addams's 100th birthday, according to the...
Oh, Addams Family creator. Pay attention.
Yeah.
Heaven's sakes. 100th birthday of Charles Addams. Had he actually, of course, been around?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, he was, but he is no longer.
Right.
Robot Chicken last night had a clip-on thing. And he married Emma Jig.
Yeah.
You have Emma some...
Jig. Yes.
You have some unique... And I'll put it that way. Unique programs...
Good way to put it.
...that you watch.
Never seen Robot Chicken?
No, I can't say that, you know, that's really entertained my life, not even for a half a second.
Right.
But, so, yeah. No, you don't hate. That's why they make so many different channels, so many different programs.
That's right.
Robot.
That's right. It may not necessarily take all kinds, but we certainly have all kinds.
Yeah.
So that's for sure.
That's something anyway, yeah.
Well, that's why the three of us get along so well. I was talking to somebody else, again, another person saying, you know, really miss you guys not being on. I go, on when?
Yeah, right.
Where? The radio. I said, we still are. Where? And sitting right on the counter... Is the window cling? I said, oh, try here. And, oh, there's a poster.
Yep.
I'm going to post it on the wall. Oh, geez. Oh, my wife's going to be a little upset. Because
right.
You can go back in the archives and catch up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have to tell you, last night I went to Channel 13 to talk about this same virus. And I noticed that Don Elhart, God love him, actually
he's
a very cool guy. I saw Ginny and Don. They're both really good people.
Mm-hmm.
Don Elhart actually has iPad or iPod cufflinks.
He would.
I was just, and I told him, I said, you've not only drunk the Kool-Aid, you've mixed your own batch.
He is quite a techno. I mean, you know, I've been over to his house to work on his computer hit, and I've worked on Jenny's,
yep.
Both of them. But he is quite the computer savvy person. I mean... He was doing stuff back when, and, you know, oh, what about this and this? Okay, you know, I pointed him to a number of different programs and that for, like, saving passwords and all this other stuff. And, boy, he just took to it like a fish does to water.
Yep. And it was really kind of funny because we were just gently kidding him about that. we were talking about the virus, and he says he's a PC guy except for his iPad.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of desktops, he's still a PC guy, and he was worried about this thing hitting him. And I told him, you know, same thing I'll tell everybody. First, make sure your antivirus is up to date. And there, you know, we talk often about the leapfrog effect, the bad guys and the good guys and who leapfrogs who. And I said, your best bet is to not go to your banking website for a few days until the next time your antivirus updates.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I've heard recommended is use a Linux boot CD.
Yep.
As the only thing you do to go to your bank.
Right.
Because it's CD is read only, you know, nothing can infect you when you're booted from that CD.
Right. True. Or WUBI, WUBI is Linux inside of Windows. It's essentially an icon on your desktop, and it creates a virtual machine inside your desktop,
oh, okay, cool.
The Windows desktop of Linux.
Then you know you're safe.
Right. Right, right. So those are very cool things. Wubi is something a lot of people should look into if you're at all interested in this whole
Wubi,
Linux
they're probably nonsense. Thinking you're talking Star Wars.
Yeah, probably. But
no, that's Wookiee.
That would be Wookiee. Right.
I know, but they're so close.
Don't upset the Star Wars fans.
Right. Mm. But yeah, so it's something to be very careful of. And I have to say, whatever else you may think of these virus writers, this is an incredibly sophisticated virus.
Well, talk a little more about what you were talking there on the air.
Yeah, so
I'm trying to find. They don't have a link on their website yet.
Yeah, they don't.
To it.
They may not. They may not. I don't know. I looked last night. I looked this morning. The other stories that were on at the same time are up there, but not this one. But really, it's an amazing thing. It waits. It does nothing until you go to your banking site. Mm-hmm. So you could have it for months and not know it. Right?
Yep.
Then you go to your banking site, and in the background, it doesn't pop up anything. It doesn't ask you for anything. It doesn't do any of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It just steals all the information from your banking site. And then it starts making transactions, you know, and buying stuff and sending it to whoever, doing
and
whatever.
And if you don't monitor that on a daily basis.
Well, but here's the problem. How do you monitor it? Because when you go to look at your transaction list, it remembers what it bought. And as the HTML code comes in, before it shows up on your browser, this software strips out all its own transactions and then adjusts the total.
To look like it's still
to look
it
like
didn't
take
it out.
Didn't do anything.
Oh, okay.
So because it's in between you and the website, right? It's in between your browser and the website.
That's
it pulls
some creative coding.
It really is. Pulls all the stuff down from the website.
Damn.
And it removes everything before it shows it to you.
So maybe check it on your smartphone that can't get infected by this particular Trojan.
Right, right. Check it on a different machine. Check. Get a browser like Lynx, either Links or Lynx, that is a text-only browser. I don't know if that's vulnerable. It's only a PC virus right now. Right now,
yeah.
So
give
Mac,
them a couple days,
right? Mac people and Linux people are okay, but yeah, I mean, if you have a smartphone or you have a tablet, check your balance on there, and that will not be infected. So you should be okay that way, and in fact, do your transactions there. Don't use your computer to go to your bank website.
One other thing that we found very helpful for folks, and we've talked about this before, is, all right, you know, with, say, a Windows 7 machine, you know, by default, the people put themselves as administrator.
Yeah, never do that.
That's not a good idea, folks. You know, have the administrator be the administrator account. Set up a second one for you with limited access.
I remember some version of Windows that used to do that. Was it Windows XP Pro where you create an administrator account and then you have to create a user account?
Mm-hmm.
No, it was NT Server.
NT Server, yeah. Something like
definitely
that.
Definitely did that.
One of them used to do
but
that.
By setting that up and then using that, because you have limited access, things can't get in there and make changes. It says, no, you can't.
And when you set up that first account and it's an administrator account, don't name it administrator.
No.
Name it something weird.
Yeah.
You know, give it a name.
Give it your
Fred
last
Mary.
Name. Your last name.
Yeah, doesn't Windows by default have an administrator account that
you don't
control?
But you can rename it. You can go in there and rename it.
Yeah, you have to go in and rename it yourself.
Right,
yeah.
You can go in and rename it.
Yeah. Under the accounts. In the control panel, you can go to users and select that account, and one of the options is rename.
And even having a second account is good anyway. In case something goes wrong in the first account, you can log into the second account and still get to some of
and
your
the
stuff.
Basic idea is by using a non-admin account for your day-to-day use, if you get infected, it has much less chance of being everywhere in your system. There are places it will be locked out of. If it's using, it'll try to escalate its privileges, but if it can't, then it's
too bad, so sad.
Right.
You're not getting there.
So you're much better off not using your admin account.
Mm-hmm.
So have an admin account, rename it to something else, and then use that account to change the privileges on your regular login account, your Nick account, your Dave account, your Steve account,
right.
to user,
limited
not administrator.
Use.
Right.
Limited use.
Right. Right.
And then that way you can't make the changes, you know, as far as installing the software or changing printers or all this other stuff. You don't have the rights to do it.
Right. And the reality is once your system is set up, you're really going to do those things very irregularly.
Yeah, you don't need
to. You're going to install little pieces of software maybe that you'll need to do it with. But other than that, it's just going to be day-to-day running it, and you'll be much safer if you do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. The and we Linux people know all about that because we don't run as administrators, generally speaking. We know enough not to do that.
Right.
We have the sudo command, so I suppose we can still do that.
Sudo make me a sandwich.
Yeah, right. I don't know. On Mac, it's a mock kernel, so I don't know if you...
It's the same sudo. Yeah, okay. we're an administrator, but we're not root. The root account is disabled by default, and you have to go through hoops to enable the root account.
That's the way to do it. That is a good way to do it. So, in general, when you have a new system, think about these things before you start setting it up.
Yeah.
Or if you're already using an account, then you've got a little bit of a problem, because if you've got all your email and all your documents and everything else under administrator, then you do have to jump through some hoops. But I bet
you can make a new administrator account and then downgrade your level to standard user.
Right. Limited user.
That's probably
the
easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
Create a new account, call it something else, make an administrator, use that account to downgrade the account you normally use to a regular user, and rename that if it was administrator, if that's what it is. Rename it to something else. Now, what that also means is you're going to have to log in every time.
Right.
Which so what?
You sort of should anyway.
Yeah.
You
and to actually, be safe.
From the service perspective that Dave and I run into, that helps you remember your password when you have to type it in every time you turn the machine on. Yep. I can't say how many times we've asked people their passwords. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No,
I never use it.
And let me forestall a couple of points. First, the first thing people will say is, I can't remember passwords. Yeah, I know. You're hiding behind your own stupidity. I personally don't think you're that stupid. If you want to think that, that's fine. I don't think you are. The second thing is, well, it takes so long to log in. It takes maybe an extra 8 seconds. And you're also not that important that you can't wait another 8 seconds to log in. I'm sorry. It's just the reality. So go ahead and set up some passwords.
And there's been some interesting research. Steve Gibson, Gibson Research, has a password haystack page. And he's been able to show that a longer password is much better than a cryptic password. So it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. You can remember that. And that's really, really long. And a brute force attack will take trillions of centuries to guess every single letter. Even if you have a short password, Steve, and then do pound, 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 make it 20 characters. And the longer it is, the better. It doesn't have to be this horrible
17-character minimum. 17-character minimum. Ginny was very upset about that yesterday when I told her that. But yeah, and we can talk more about that when we come back. But we are going to take a quick break right now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave, Steve, me, Nick, and all of you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on the wonderful, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, yes, you did hear that right. It's in the 40s. On the 7th of January, it's in the 40s.
I got to tell you, these close to getting the bike out yesterday.
I bet.
Oh, I saw some folks out there riding. It's like, oh, darn, if I hadn't had to do a couple other jobs.
Right.
Just to get on it and say I rode it, because I did. What was that one winter? Winter didn't really start until it was like the third week of January, and then it hit us like a, you know, nobody's business. But I remember that Wednesday. It was a Wednesday night, and it got up to 72 degrees that day.
Yep.
Got home, and Lori said, let's go up to Park Ave. We gotta ride.
You gotta.
We couldn't get out to the garage fast enough. Moved the tractor outside.
The tractor with the snowplow in the front that you weren't really using at 72 degrees.
Quick unplug, you know, covered the bike.
Right.
Unhooked the battery tender. Pulled out the helmets because they were all packed away. But again, it only takes a couple minutes.
Right.
Bam, we're on that bike and down to Park Ave. And it's like, yes, we can say we were out in January.
Yep, that's the way it works.
Oh, it was a beautiful night that night. And, you know, like I say,
Yeah.
Wasn't shortly thereafter.
Well, right.
Right down the tubes and ain't happening anymore.
Right. But here it is. It's a beautiful day today, and we're going to talk to Victor from Irondequoit. Welcome, Victor. What's your question?
Some computer people at work were telling me to get rid of temporary files, use the percent, temp percent,
yeah,
instead of C cleaner. What's your opinion?
Six of one.
Yeah, half a dozen the other.
Is, right. What you do is if you go into, if you use percent, temp percent, what that is a system command that essentially says, bring up where my temporary files are kept. Depending on which version of Windows you have, it's either TEMP or TMP. Sadly,
or both
right? Sadly, Windows has not been consistent over the years, not just Windows itself, but also it depends on which version of Office you have and a couple of other things. So you should really do both. But by looking in those two directories, the percent temp percent and the percent TMP percent, bringing those up, you could be able to see all of the files that you have that are temp files and get rid of them. The big thing about temp files to remember is go ahead and try to delete all of them. If one does not want to delete, it's because it's in use. Then you skip it and move on. So you can't really hurt the system by saying, go ahead and get rid of everything, because it will stop you if it can't.
You can also use the disk cleanup utility in Windows. Right-click on your hard drive, and there's a tools command. It empties your recycle bin. It cleans your temporary internet files. It cleans some of these temp files out also.
So CCleaner is okay to use anyway, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, you can still use it, but I mean, it doesn't hurt to double check just in case it missed something.
I see they have a Mac version out now, too.
Okay. Thanks very much, guys.
You're welcome.
Yep. It's very cool. The things about like CCleaner and stuff like that actually do all that for you, so you don't have to do it yourself. So a product like CCleaner is not a bad product to use. You shouldn't. There's no reason not to use it. It really does most of that stuff. What it won't do is if you've got certain types of files in very weird places that are just so unusual that it wouldn't know about them. But in general, it should work fine.
There's also a couple of different programs that claim to clean up duplicate files and stuff on your computer. There's one on the Mac called Spring Cleaning. And those, oftentimes, they run and then give you a list. Here's all the duplicate files I found. Do you want to delete them? And how are you supposed to know that's why you bought the program?
Yeah.
Right.
And then, you know, how is it supposed to know,
And no,
too?
I don't want to delete all of them because is that all of them? I should keep one.
Right. And maybe they're duplicated for a reason. And
right.
So it's some of these cleaning programs can get too adventurous and cause more problems. That's why it's, you know, CCleaner is a nice one that
right.
works safely.
Even so, you need to have a little bit of an idea of what's going on in your machine. I wouldn't just willy-nilly.
Yeah, no, you've got to have some knowledge
programs.
Because, yeah, it's so easy to all of a sudden, that's like you'll never hear us, or at least me on this show, and I know Steve either, or you, ever tell folks how to go in and make adjustments in the registry.
Right.
It's just something we do not want to be responsible for because all it takes is one swoop of deleting a key that you didn't mean to, and then you're hosed.
That's exactly right.
You could delete things, and then the machine isn't booting, and I only deleted this one file. That's all you needed to do.
That's right.
Hello, if you don't know what you're deleting or in there, because there are literally thousands of entries in that registry. And if you go mucking around in there and don't know what the heck you're doing, you could do some serious damage.
Yeah. To which, can you fix it? Well, define fix.
Yeah.
I can certainly wipe it all out and install clean. Mm-hmm. That's about all that's left now.
Yeah, because now with Windows 7, Windows XP, we were able to do the feature of putting Windows over Windows.
Yep.
Windows 7, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't do an install over an install. It wants to redo everything.
And there's no repair install option?
None that I've found that works.
Well, the real problem
installing
is
like the old day, Windows over Windows.
Right, yep. And the big thing is Windows XP also had two copies of the registry. So it would take the second copy and use that as it was doing that restore. The Windows 7 still has one, but it's much more aggressive about backing up.
Yeah.
So the likelihood that you've still got a clean copy on the backup is nil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Depending on how damaged your Windows 7 installation is, you can do an in-place upgrade. And that sometimes works. Maybe.
Yeah, and sometimes the restore points. You know, if you got those on, you can do that. But
maybe. But yeah, the best thing is to just not muck about in the registry at all.
Have a good backup and make sure everything works and don't muck about.
Yeah. And when we say backup, don't worry about the Windows program because you're going to have to reinstall that anyways. But you definitely want to save if there's on there the hard drive. Say all your documents and, you know, pictures and photos and all that type of stuff and music if you want that. Along with, now if you've got, say, a folder for all your drivers, if the manufacturer put the drivers folder on there, Dell's very well known for this, so is HP, that they've got a folder off the root directory that says drivers. And you want to copy that too. That way, if you have to reinstall Windows, all the current drivers are there for your video card, your motherboard, network card, USB ports, the whole nine yards. It's all there. And you can just click on them and reinstall one at a time. But, right. You know, it's a good idea to back those up because more and more companies aren't including the CDs with it anymore. You get the license.
One thing is the recovery.
Mac started doing that now with 10.7 Lion. You could have a recovery partition and no physical disk. Right. Mm-hmm. Instructions on how to make a disk, but no one does that.
What I always tell people to do now when they buy a new machine is make sure everything goes under the documents folder, including where you save your mail and where you put your bookmarks. And then buy a program like Carbonite or whatever and back up everything in the documents directory. That's the way to do it because then everything is backed up. You don't have to worry about it anymore. You're on your way. All right, listen, we're going to go back to the phones. We're going way out west to Orchard Park, New York. Welcome, Joe. How's the weather out there?
Partly sunny.
There you go.
So there must be no game today.
Yeah.
Bills play on Sunday.
Yeah. So what can we do for you, Joe?
I thought I would build a little bit upon your security suggestions there a little earlier about running as an ordinary account. Now, unfortunately, the Windows security model and their process model and so forth makes it extraordinarily painful to do anything as the administrator. Yeah, you have to, like, log out, log in again, run as. You always have to provide your the administrator password.
Right.
So,
well, but that's security.
I'm sorry, did you say
that's
something?
Security, right? That's the whole point of security, to make sure that nobody who doesn't have that password can do things on your machine.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Mm-hmm. Security is difficult by its very nature. If it was easy, it wouldn't be secure.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
But there is, I think it's open source. It's definitely free, but I think it's open source, something called SudoWin. It is sudo, which we've had on Linux and Unix-like systems for a long time, to let you do something, a command at a time, and have your credentials cached, and that was brought to the Windows platform. It works a lot like run as, with a few key differences. Again, like the Unix sudo, you provide your own password, not the administrator's password, and that spawns the program as yourself, but with the administrator's what is it called? It's a token added to your security token.
Right.
So that it allows you to do administrator things in that one program that you've spawned, and it caches your credentials for, I think the default is 5 minutes. So you're not constantly typing your password if you have to do a series of commands to accomplish something.
Nice. Very nice.
Nice.
And Steve is putting that up on our links list. Sudo for Windows, very, very nice.
Hasn't been updated in a while, though.
I think it's... I'm sorry, Steve?
It hasn't been updated in a while, June 2011.
Yeah, that is true. But hopefully it doesn't need any updating.
Right.
Hopefully
maybe
there's no vulnerabilities in it. Well, thanks very much for your time, folks.
No, thank you. Appreciate it. That's a great tip on that piece of software. I like it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Have fun. Very, very nice. Actually, very, very nice. Sudo is a command line thing originally in Unix Linux, I'm trying to type and talk at the same time, which lets you run with administrator privileges, but you don't have to know the administrator password. So, for example, on Linux...
Well, yeah, you have to know the password. You don't have to be logged into that account.
You have to know your password. With sudo, you put in your password, not the root password.
Right.
And so, for example, on my machine, the root password is... The root is disabled. It has no password. You can't log in as root. You can't do any of that stuff. But if I want to run a root command, I can say sudo... blah, 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 and I'll say, okay, what's your password? And I type in my password, and up it comes. Now, the same thing now is available for Windows. You can run a command as the administrator with the administrator's privileges, but you don't have to know the administrator password because you can run it as yourself. In Linux, you have to be in the sudo group. You have to be allowed to run sudo, and I'm sure that's the same in sudo win, or win sudo, whichever it is, sudo win. Yeah. I'm sure it's the same there, where you have to, as administrator, set up who can run sudo. So if you don't want your kids to be able to run things as an administrator, you simply don't put them in the file.
Yep. It's basically short for super user do.
Yeah.
You're going to do something as the super user, which can do anything on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's a very powerful command. When you're in a Linux system, I use it, I use it all the time to do certain things that I need a quick utility run over the entire drive. Well, I could log out, log in as administrator and run it, or I could just use sudo. And now there's one for Windows, which is a very nice feature to have. You have to remind yourself not to use it too often. Well, because
lies the challenge.
Right, because the reality is that there are simply things you need to think three times before you do on any computer. And when you have to, when you find yourself typing sudo or clicking on the sudo win icon, that's the moment where you need to sit back and say, is this trip really necessary? Because if
for
it's
not... For a
good
time, sudo star... rem star dot...
right, rm space star minus F, yeah.
We knew it was going that way with him.
Right. it's important to understand what it is you're doing and why doing it.
Especially with spaces. We used to have a procedure on the Mac for deleting user accounts where you typed in... There's an rm for remove, and then it was slash... star dot tmp or something like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And somebody typed in slash space star.
Oh.
Which means delete everything. File on the computer. And
yep.
And so he sat there watching every single line because it was telling you every line it deleted. Deleted.
Yep.
It went on for like 10 minutes and he said, I think I did something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little bit.
And that's why it's so important to be very careful when you do things with sudo or as the administrator. And that's why we always tell people, think at least twice and better yet three times before you run that sudo command, before you run as administrator. And that's why you shouldn't run as administrator normally. We all do stupid things, and we should all use every possible method to make ourselves less likely to do stupid things. In the meantime, we're going to do something very smart, which is take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more of Sound Bites, the longest-running computer show in the known universe, right here on the magnificent, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Rich from Rochester on the line. Welcome, Rich. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Some friends had told me that there's ways to write apps for, like, your Android phone.
Yes. Many people do.
How is that done, or where would I might start to do that?
There are a couple of ways to do that. If you are familiar with HTML5 and CSS and JavaScript, there is a product called Titanium, which is a free product.
Okay.
That will lead you through doing that. So if you know Android, if you know that stuff, you can do it. If you are one of the many old timers who remembers HyperCard,
no,
there's a product called Live Code from Revolution Software at runrev.com that lets you write code in. That's expensive though.
Uh-huh.
That's hundreds of dollars per platform.
Yeah, so I don't think I'm looking for something like that. I'm kind of maybe looking for something maybe web-based or, like you said, a free download program or something.
Well, Titanium is it Titanium? Yeah, from AppCelerator, I think. What? Oh, there it is. Yes, he's got it. Yes, AppCelerator is the company. Titanium is the product.
It translates your HTML and CSS into Objective-C or Java so that you can host
right,
it as an application.
All you have to do is to be able to write HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript.
Okay.
And it will then compile that into both, depending on which platform you want to make it for, Android, iPad. I think it also does Windows 7 phone and maybe BlackBerry. I don't have it in front of me, but it does all of those things, and you just simply compile for the target platform you want. There used to be one from Google. They've discontinued it.
Oh, okay.
And I forget what that was called, but that was really easy. It was essentially like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. But I would take a look at Titanium. It is free. You need a bunch of additional free products to go with it. For example, the Android SDK software development kit, which is free from Google.
Uh-huh.
But once you've got all the pieces and parts together, you just write HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript, and bang, you've got a program you can put out in the market.
Now you're talking a little Greek with that other stuff of learning that code. Is that something hard to learn, or
no? It just takes it. Well, you have to have a bit of a bent toward programming, obviously, for any of these things. But there's nothing. There's no magic bullet here. You do have to know how to code something to be able to write apps.
Okay.
You know, there's no. I mean, there's no magic.
Boy, that brings back days.
Yeah,
doing PL1 and Fortran.
I mean, is there places to go or place? I don't know, book maybe. I guess or
probably
something
the dummy
to,
series.
There's a bunch of books available. There's somebody wrote a book on Titanium as well. We have various local groups in town. There is a group in town that did. There's the Linux users group, and was it them that had a Titanium special interest group? Hold on a second.
There's App Rochester.
Rochester.
They do mostly iPhone apps.
Okay.
No, well, their December 6th meeting was on developing for Windows Phone, so I guess
they do a little bit of everything.
Out,
so
yeah.
App Rochester, which is at what? AppRochester.something?
.wordpress.com.
AppRochester.wordpress.com.
Okay.
Would be a terrific place to start, and Steve will put that in the link list as well. But it is not impossible to do, and in fact many, many people do it. I just had a story last year about a 15-year-old kid who made $1 million writing an app.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be dragged out shopping today, so I'll probably maybe stop at Barnes & Noble and see if I can pick something up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know any programming languages now?
No, I don't. At least I don't think I do.
Yeah,
you would know if you did.
Yeah.
You can start with something simple.
With my laptop and things like that, but, you know, I mean, a lot of...
programming is programming.
Yeah, you can start with something simple like HTML and then move into Objective-C, CSS, Objective-C, Ruby.
Objective-C is a pain in the patoot. I don't care how good a programmer you are. It's just...
Yeah.
C is... Well, I'm not going to get into the
HTML, you might be able to get the Dummy Series book on that.
Okay.
But HTML is just the basic web stuff, and if you add CSS, that's simply the way it looks. You know, what fonts you use, what colors you use, things like that. The slightly more difficult one is JavaScript, but depending on what you're writing, you may not need any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So take it a step at a time, and you'll get there.
HTML I would recommend first.
Yep.
Okay.
Get your head around that.
Then go to CSS.
Because that's just making things prettier.
Right, and then JavaScript.
Okay, great. Thanks for the direction. Maybe, like I said, I'll go out and look for some books today or something and to maybe look into that program you guys mentioned also.
Right, HTML5 first, then CSS, then JavaScript.
Okay.
There you go.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
And there's probably books on titanium as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Just hit the net.
One nice thing about the Mac is it comes with a lot of programming environments built in. You get Objective-C, you get Ruby, you get PHP, you get Python. All that's built into the Mac, hidden under there that average people don't need to see. But if you're looking to program, it's already in there.
Right. And if you program in those languages, that's great. But if you're going to be programming, a lot of people just aren't going to get into Objective-C, certainly not as their first language.
That's okay, Linda. You can let it go.
I remember when I was taking programming, we looked at C as a future language that might be used someday.
Well,
because I took Fortran and COBOL and Pascal and PL1.
Right. I did quite a bit of PL1.
Yeah. Right. Kernighan and Ritchie looked at it as a language that wrote operating systems and kind of looked askance at using it for other things.
Yeah.
But what do they know?
I can remember having to do one semester that I had to take compiler, just basic.
Yeah.
And doing it on punch cards.
Yep.
There's still
you want to do basic.
Oh, my goodness.
What you really want to learn is assembler.
They're still selling OPascal.
Yeah, that's what we were doing. That's the language, assembler language. Yes, we had to.
That's the book we all learned Pascal on. Pascal. Right.
We had to literally, in assembler language, lay it down in the sheets, and then this girl would type up the cards. We would go back the following day or so, pick up our punch cards, hoping that they didn't spread all over the place, submit them to the computer room to run them.
Let me tell you what the best job in college was. Being the guy in the computer room who took and gave away the cards.
Yeah.
Because every once in a while, when we had a brand new student who looked really, really harried, when we hand them back their deck, we'd grab, because they all came in the same boxes and they all looked identical, we'd grab a different box that just was blank or fake cards, and we'd go to hand it to them and go, oops, and throw them all over the floor and just watch their faces.
Heart attack. Oh, I can remember.
It was always when we would go up to the computer window and get your printout, because you submit your program and they give you the printout. If the guy came back with a huge stack of paper,
you had a problem.
Crap, there's an infinite loop. They had it set so it would stop printing after 10,000 lines.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, ours usually came back with the printout on top of the box.
Yep.
And then you'd have to sit there and see it go to the end, see if it compiled right, and it's like, crap.
Right.
You have to go back in and see where you resubmit that card that had to be repunched. Or if you were handy enough, which I got, I did learn how, being at Kodak, I'd take it back into my friend that worked in the key room.
Oh, yeah.
This girl was fantastic. I mean, she could be talking to you and typing in stuff, numbers.
Yep.
I said, holy man. And her fingers went so darn fast, it was unbelievable.
Yep.
But she'd type it, oh, yeah, I can do that quick adjustment for you. And she'd quick type it up. Here you go. I didn't have to, and I'd take the deck back that next night. Yes.
Yep.
Or you forget a period.
Have I got? Yeah, exactly. or a semicolon.
Yes.
Have I got time for this?
You've got. Go ahead. 5 minutes.
Okay. Five Facebook minutes. Users have a new threat to look out for. It's called the Ramnet worm, and it has compromised 45,000 user accounts. Ramnet was discovered in 2010. The following year, the software was used by hackers to infect 800,000 computers and gain remote access to financial institutions, compromise online banking sessions, and penetrate several corporate networks. Now the worm is targeting Facebook users located primarily in the UK and France. When hackers take control of a Facebook account, they can use the profile to spam other users with malicious links that further spread malware like Ramnet. John Weinschenk, CEO at Sensic security firm, expressed concerns that compromised Facebook credentials could lead to a rash of unauthorized online banking activities. Bank account numbers and Facebook login credentials seem very different, but to hackers they are equally as lucrative, Weinschenk said. With Facebook credentials, hackers have the ability to propagate the malware, placing it on the walls of thousands of people who then spread it to others, because many people use the same username and password on multiple websites. There's also the added risk associated with hackers gaining additional access to other social networking websites, email accounts, and corporate networks. Facebook, however, says that Ramnet is not a growing threat to users. Fred Wolins of the social network's public policy team said that Facebook has been aware of the problem for a week and has taken steps to stop the worm in its tracks. He went on to say that the social network has been working to help restore compromised accounts. People can protect themselves by never clicking on strange links and reporting any suspicious activity they encounter on Facebook. Become fans of the Facebook security page at, and this is a shock, facebook.com/security. For additional security information, and Steve will put that link up as well. Facebook is no stranger to hackers. On Wednesday, Facebook opened registrations for its second annual Hacker Cup, where talented programmers from around the world will compete in a series of algorithmic challenges to win a trip to Facebook HQ. Ooh. And, of course, the possibility of a job offer from the world's largest social network. How are you protecting yourself against the Facebook worm? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
For folks that didn't see this, because this is radio, unless you're viewing this on the camera, I'm sorry, it's too much. Nick starts to read it. Before he even got going, he puts his finger up to stop Steve.
I didn't say a word.
No. See, this is where I get to see it from this side. You're putting up your finger, and Steve's getting me like, what? Stopping him dead in his tracks. I wish I had the camera then, because the expression on both of your two faces was unreal. It was one of those Kodak moments that I missed.
Right.
Right. You guys provide me with a lot of entertainment. What can I say? Being on this side now versus sitting in between the two of you. Now I can see what Rob missed or used to put up with. But it is, Facebook is still, folks don't realize, and they put sometimes too much information. Just too much information out there.
I am absolutely amazed at the people who talk about what people talk about on there. I'm not even going to go through it, but it's amazing. There are people who have no censor in their heads anymore.
Some of it is the perception of anonymity, or it's a private message. Anything you put on the internet will be seen by somebody else you don't want to see.
Yeah, especially if they pass it on to somebody else.
Well, and even if you have all your privacy settings turned on and you know you're only sending it to your friends, there are things that happen and things leak out. But one of your friends sends it to someone you don't know, and suddenly it's everywhere.
Bam.
Anything you type on the internet could be seen by anybody anywhere, and just sort of keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Well, but people don't care anymore. This is the point. The kids these days,
mm-hmm.
anybody from 10 on up, they absolutely, I used to joke about Twitter in the bathroom,
yep.
Feeling relieved. But people do it. And mm-hmm. on Facebook, they put pictures of themselves, finished my abortion. Or, I'm pregnant, or
Ron White, Blue Collar Comedy. You ever take a crap so big your pants fit better?
Okay.
You knew. Oh,
if there is.
And then you put it on Twitter, yeah?
Right. If there is a way to get lower than low, Steve will get us there in one leap.
That's what I mean. That's why when you put your finger up to stop, it's like I knew where that was coming.
I can lower the quality of that conversation in one sentence.
But it's interesting to see that the difference between what Facebook has become and what Google Plus has become.
Yes.
That it's sort of Facebook is the masses and Google Plus is the techno elite.
Well, now a lot of the masses are going to Google Plus.
Yep.
What's different about Google Plus is it's much easier to do some of the things that you could always do in Facebook, but either nobody knew or it's harder to do. Right. Yep. And then there are things like Hangouts, which are just phenomenal. I really like Hangouts. I do them fairly regularly with students and stuff like that. And I'm very, very much impressed by what it does. And of course, now that thanks to Dave, I have my, thanks to Dan, I have my Chromebook back. I'm in good shape. All right, listen, we're going to take a break.
Both of us.
Yep. I'm going to take a break. That's what I said. Thanks to Dave and thanks to Dan. We're going to take a break back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, and we are going to be back in just a couple of minutes right here on the truly magnificent, member-supported Jazz 90.1. So don't go away. Stay tuned. Come back and join us. It's a whole nother hour to waste.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Oh, Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And in 4 minutes after the hour, you have yet another chance to waste an hour of your life with sound bites.
Or gain some really useful information.
If you're listening to something else, sure.
One thing, before you get into that, I want to remind folks, this is kind of a PSA anyways, the second annual Pancake Breakfast is coming up, and that's going to be March 10th. It's going to be here at Grease Olympia High School. It's in the large cafeteria, 1139 Maiden Lane. But tickets are going on sale February 6th. And you're going to want to get your tickets early, folks, because last year there was SRO. I mean, there was a lot of folks standing around because there were no seats.
And how many pancakes did you serve?
Oh, there was
thousands.
Yeah,
something
the
ridiculous?
Kiwanis group that I belonged to, we cooked up a ton of pancakes with the help of other folks in that, and it was just phenomenal. The other thing is, see, it goes from from 10 to 1 o'clock that they're serving. It's only $5. $5 gets you in the door, gets you, all the pancakes, sausage that you can eat, juice that you can drink, and coffee. You also get in on some great giveaways and raffles that we're going to have. Plus, if it's anything like last year's show, from 10 to 12, the polka guys were playing. They had folks dancing in the aisles.
It was fun to watch.
It was a riot. And then from 12 to 2, of course, we did our computer show.
Right, and you can stick around for the whole 2 hours, but they stopped serving at 1.
Right. And, so that's why we're advising folks, February 6th, put it on your calendar that you can start getting your tickets for the second annual Pancake Breakfast, and you're going to have some great entertainment from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
It's going to be great.
Yep. And again, it's March 10th.
It's only
10th.
$5.
For $5. All the food that you can
eat. Yeah, it's ridiculous to not come.
Yeah.
Come and join us and sit around and we'll chit-chat.
Yep.
Here's an interesting news story. Though the biggest gripe for most iPhone 4S users has been an abnormally short battery life, an issue that could prove to be just as frustrating is gaining vocal ground in support forums across the web. iPhone 4S owners are experiencing random muting during phone calls, an issue that has reportedly been ignored in the forthcoming iOS 5.1 update. The problem happens as calls are placed. You tap the appropriate contact or dial the number you wish to call, and at some point during the connection, the audio on the caller's end fails. Interestingly, on the other end, the call recipients have reported no issues at all. They can even hear the caller's frustration with the lack of audio on the opposite side. So, what's to blame? Right now, nobody knows. First finger point is always at software. There were so many variables at play with software development, it seems much more likely for a weird occurrence like this to be related to coding missteps, competing software installations, user configurations. Some people disagree with the software theory, however. They blame hardware failures on the iPhone 4S and its capability to connect and stay connected to cellular networks. Despite a thread of more than 100 pages and growing on Apple's own support community's website and countless other Apple-centric support forums on many other sites around the internet, the call muting bug seems to have missed the list of issues being addressed by Apple in the latest iOS update. So if you had a call muting issue with your iPhone 4S or any other model running iOS 5, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or, of course, toll-free, 790-0415, just like Sandy did, from all the way out in Webster, New York. Welcome, Sandy. What's your question?
Oh, I have an issue with my laptop. I have a Dell Inspiron. And a couple weeks ago, it did the same thing where all of a sudden I couldn't get my mouse to work and had to rely on the touchpad that I hate. Now, it happened again this week, and I've been fighting with it all week, hoping you can tell me why my USB device is not recognized. Doesn't matter which of the three ports I use.
If you reboot, does it come back?
No.
Do other USB devices work?
Nothing.
Failed USB on the computer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all three of them, all at once?
Well, there's probably only one chip controlling all the ports.
Yeah, it's a controller chip that controls all three ports.
Oh,
that hands out the address.
Sounds like it's more than I can handle, then.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this a desktop or a laptop?
A laptop.
Well, yeah. If it was a desktop, you could put a USB card in pretty cheap.
Yeah.
There are USB cards for laptops. They're generally not cheap. They go into the Express card slot or the PC card slot on your laptop.
Yeah, but no. This is, if you've tried, say, like a thumb drive, Sandy, on this,
mm-hmm.
I know who this lady is.
You know, yes, you do.
And, yeah, if you've put a thumb drive into the side and it doesn't even recognize that.
Ooh, BIOS. It's possible that somehow USB got turned off in BIOS.
You could check there.
Something to check, at least. Yeah.
And when you're setting, you know, turning on the laptop, if you hit the delete key or it'll tell you F1 to go into the BIOS, you'd have to look at the various screens where it'll say USB and see if that by accident got turned off. But I don't think, unless you went in and changed it yourself, it's not likely that that's going to get changed in the BIOS.
No, I haven't ever seen. I got something a couple of weeks ago, like I said, it did the same thing, and I really was proud of myself to fix it. And then a couple of days ago, it just stopped working again. And
I think that's something going on the motherboard.
Yeah, it might be a driver issue, but it does sound like motherboard.
Yeah,
I reloaded my driver disk.
Do you have any slot at all on the computer, a PC MCIA slot or card bus or anything like that?
Yes.
You can get USB cards. I'm Googling around and I'm seeing cards from $8 to $20, depending on
what kind of slot. Well, I'm going to give one of those a try, and I really appreciate your help.
Yeah, give that a shot. Certainly, if you've got, first make sure of what type of slot you have, and then buy that particular card. And if it solves the problem for, you know, anywhere between $8 and $20, you're in good shape.
You're right, and I thank you so much.
All right, sure. Sandy, I was also going to say, if you want to bring it in, we'll probably be stopping in this coming week.
I know you will, yeah.
Yeah, well, we've got that one machine, and if you want, you know, find out, we'll let you know when we're coming in, and we can bring that laptop in, and I'll take a quick look at it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay.
It's been great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.
Thanks, Sandy. That's a problem. I have to actually check my BIOS.
Like I say, it's very unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, that gets turned off. I mean,
yeah, but
most devices don't.
Unlikely things happen all the time.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, though, even viruses, they don't want to turn it off, or spyware, because if you're hooking up a device and it turns that device off and you're hooking up, because jump drives have become so famous. What's scary is there's no 99% of them, there is no locking device. That's why I like to use the ones with the SD card in them, because you can lock those down.
On my machine at home, I'm recently having a problem, which is that all of a sudden the keyboard and the mouse stop responding. If I reboot, they come back for a while, and then they go away again. And I'm not entirely certain why that's happening yet. This is because it doesn't happen all the time. And, of course, when it happens, there seems to be no indication in the syslog as to why that's happening. So I'm not entirely certain what to do about it. I've been Googling around the Internet for fixes, and one of the things that people have said they do is if they have those all-in-one cards like I have in my machine, you know, that you can put in an SD card or an MMC card or all of those other things to unplug that, because those are causing issues. And so I'll give that a try when I go home.
Yeah.
See if that fixes the problem. But it's really getting annoying, because it happens at least once a day. And
you've done the updated drivers.
I've got all the latest everything.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's just starting to pork me off a little bit. So I'm not sure.
Now, you're using PS2 or USB?
Me? I'm using USB.
Okay.
I don't think I have any PS2 in my system anyway.
I was wondering if you could try another USB, say, keyboard or mouse.
I've tried different mice. I've tried different keyboards.
It's still the same thing.
It simply stops responding to any USB device. Well, I reboot and they all come back.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a pain to patoot.
Something's patooted up. So I'm going to try removing that, see if that causes. I'll just unplug it. I mean, I'll just
give it a shot.
Trace the wire and unplug it somewhere and see what happens.
You can do that.
But I just have to do it.
Pain in the butt.
All right. Our next caller is Bill from Greece, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's your question?
I was reading Popular Mechanics this month, and they have an article about removing yourself from the Internet.
Right.
And they say about getting this software. It says getcocoon.com. I wonder if you had heard anything about it.
What's it called?
G-E-T Cocoon, C-O-C-O-O-N.com.
I have not heard about it, and I can't get there because...
We're blocked.
We're blocked. This seems to think it's a virus.
Uh-huh.
Which is interesting.
Hmm.
Are you looking at it on Google?
I just Googled for it. I'm trying to find the Wikipedia entry on it to see what it actually does.
Yeah.
There's an Apache plugin called Cocoon. That's probably not it. Yeah, it's a privacy site. It looks like it's a program you install and try to download into your computer. So right off the bat, I'm wary of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Although Popular Mechanics theoretically would be able to do that stuff. But the fact is that the Greece Central School District, through whom we get our Internet access, seems to think it's a malicious site,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. They could certainly be wrong about that, but that's what they think. So I've never really seen it or played with it, I'm afraid.
Supposed to keep you, it says, leaving the web behind might be likely key to your privacy insanity.
They mean get off the Internet entirely.
Don't use the Internet, period. And then,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But anything you've already done on the Internet is archived there permanently, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, not even Cocoon will get rid of that.
Yeah, because it could be buried on so many other servers and things tucked away.
Well, there's archive.org.
Yeah.
Which has the Wayback Machine. You can go back and mm-hmm. look at websites going back to the 80s, and if you've put something there, it's still archived there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking about getting a new machine because this one's sort of loaded up with who knows what, and I thought I was going to try this to keep the new one clean.
Yep. I don't know that that's the best product to do that with. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I can't really do any research on it here because they block me. And I haven't seen. I'm not having trouble finding a place for it. I apologize.
See what we can do maybe by next week.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Or if anybody else has heard about it.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. If you've heard about it out there, give us a call. Let us know. The number 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or of course, toll free 1-800-790-0415. And we will be more than delighted to talk to you about Cocoon. Everything I'm seeing about it here is just...
not good.
Yeah, I'm not seeing good things on it here. All right, our next caller is Bill from Arundhati. Is this the same Bill we already talked to?
No, he was from Greece.
Oh, yeah, he was from Greece. Okay, what can we do for you?
Okay, this is going to sound like a basic question, I guess, but I have a small home network at home, and I have Linksys wireless router. I have two computers plugged into it and a Blu-ray player. I also have a laptop that is wireless, and I'm on the network so that I can go out to the Internet through the network, but I can't see the other two computers that are plugged into the network, so I can't print to a printer attached to one of the computers that are wired into the router.
What operating system are on the three of them?
Let's see. The laptop, it's a netbook, really, has Windows 7 Basic, I guess, and mm-hmm. the other two are XP Pro.
Okay.
Well, there's two things. First, Linksys has the ability to create two separate networks.
Depending on
internal networks.
The level of router you have.
Right, depending on the router you have.
Yeah, some of them call it a guest.
What is that, a WRT54?
Yeah. Well, at any rate, the point here is the wired stuff could be on one network, and the wireless stuff could be on another network, and it will be difficult to bridge the two. So that's one thing. So if that's the problem, then what you want to do is go into the admin stuff for your router and make sure they're both using the same wireless, the same address space, 192.168.1.something, right?
Okay.
If they are already on the same thing, then the problem is separate, which is likely that you don't have the same
work group name.
For the Windows machines and the Windows 7 machines.
Also, in Windows 7, under the network features and all that, there is the there's a
home sharing.
You can sit there and show whether you want to have Discovery on, whether you want to have it
Discover
and turn off. Down at the very bottom, you can also turn off passwords, so it doesn't ask you for a password to get to that other computer.
Okay. You can also open a command line and try pinging the other computer by its IP address.
Yep.
And that will let you know if the underlying networking is working okay. And then if that doesn't work, you've got a problem in your cabling or you're on the wrong networks.
The two that are connected, I can see the shared files from either computer to the other computer.
Right.
And I can print from
So my suspicion is that you've got a different work group name.
Yeah.
Okay, and in fact, that's true from
XP. How do I make a work group name on the netbook, the wireless?
Well, first thing you do is you go into the Windows to the wired machines.
Okay.
And find out the work group
name. And find out the actual work group name there, which is probably work group, all in capitals.
Yeah, it's MS
work MS
group.
Home.
MS work group or MS, MS home.
Yeah.
Once you know that, then you go into Windows 7 and you go into networking. And in setting up networking, one of the things you can do is change the name of the work group, make it exactly the same.
Okay.
Not only the name, but the case. So it's all uppercase, make it all uppercase, et cetera, et cetera. You will probably at that point need to then, after you save it, reboot.
Okay.
And from there, you should now be able to see things on the same network. So the way you want to do this is first make sure that you have everything running on the same network.
Okay.
Then make sure they're running the same work group name, and you should be okay.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. We're going to take a break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. And although you may not have realized it, we are Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, 50 degrees.
That's unreal.
On the 7th of January.
I'll take it. Hey, every day we don't have to shovel the snow.
That's exactly right.
I save money. And the way I do that is because I'm not putting down calcium chloride.
Right.
So every day
That's exactly right.
I'm loving it.
Well, you've got that driveway that drops down.
Well, it's got a slight incline. I mean, it's not a huge hill.
It's you know what?
It's
that
enough.
Slight incline in the summer is a heck of a hill in the winter.
Oh, yeah. My grandson and I, this past summer, we had a garage sale.
Of course, but it didn't sell. I've seen it there. It's still there.
Yeah. Grandpa is maybe a little bad influence on his grandson.
There's a shock.
We had this chair that we were selling. I said, Cody, we should take it up to the end of the driveway and write it down.
Oh, yeah.
He goes, really? I said, you going to go first? I said, heck yeah. So I wrote it all the way down.
Nice.
Of course he had to do it, too.
Of course he did. My daughter has already explained to me that when she has children, she's going to take them away. They will never, ever know who their grandfather is.
Well, my daughter sitting there, you know, because she was there with us, goes, you know, Dad, if he breaks an arm, you're going to help take care of him. I go, yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
No,
yeah. No, they're young. They knit easy in those days.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Greece, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
I have a laser printer for most of my work, but I also have a dot matrix printer that I use for a charity that I do the accounting for, and I like the way we bind the reports with the side pinholes. Anyway, all of a sudden, that dot matrix printer is printing gibberish. And I do a test print from the printer standalone, and it prints fine. I do a test print from the computer, and it prints gibberish. So I reloaded a driver, and it's still doing that. What's my next step?
Replace the cable between the two. It's possible that something's gone wrong with the cable between them, mm-hmm. and that the signal that's coming out of the computer is no longer the signal that's being received on the printer.
Wow.
Or some of the drivers. What version of Windows?
Well, he said he replaced the driver.
Yeah, but here's my question. What version of Windows first are you using?
XP Pro.
Okay. With some of the updates, it might have made some changes to some of the universal drivers. Because, you know, when we sit there and say a driver, everybody thinks, oh, it's just one file. No, it could be a bunch of other DLLs, dynamic link libraries, within the code that could have gotten changed. So if one of them was updated for the universal drivers, all of a sudden something that was working now might not.
You know, it failed shortly after Windows Update.
There you go.
Now, if you can remember the date and time that you did that, you can do a rollback. In other words, you can go back to a restore point just before that update. And then when Windows asks you again if you want to update, say no. So go into...
Well, certainly do the rollback and see if it works.
Yeah, give it a shot. It's nothing worth losing.
But first check that the printer cable is in tight on both ends.
Okay. It's an old, you know, LPT.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the old... Right. Anything dot matrix is.
Well, everything is dot matrix. You probably made an impact printer with pins and a ribbon?
Yes.
Yeah. But, yeah, so something old on the parallel port. I'm wondering well,
is
parallel
of
deprecated?
All the geeky things you've said, that may, in fact, be the geekiest.
Yes, really. Because when I think dot matrix, I think of all impact.
Everybody thinks of dot matrix.
A laser printer lays down dots in a matrix.
Well,
it is a dot matrix.
All dot matrix.
Oh, all printers except the select writers that had the little balls that form the character.
Balls, they're also plotters.
Yeah.
Are not dot matrix.
I love the little pens that would grab the little pen and draw the little stuff.
Yeah, HP.
I love those.
But yeah, the
plotters.
But I would, like Nick says, first check the cable, but then try a restore point. Go back. Because I'll bet you that's what happened. A DLL, Dynamic Link Library file, and it could be one of, say, 20 to 50, that got changed in that update that is now messing things up.
And then you check. It's pretty unlikely anybody's updated any drivers for a dot matrix printer in 20 years.
Not
but
happen.
You can certainly look on the manufacturer's website and see what they've got.
Yeah, I have. I have downloaded a new dot driver.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, try the. Actually, the first thing I would do is try replacing that cable.
Okay.
It may be a hardware issue in that either the. Parallel port in the computer or the parallel port in the printer itself is gone. But I would start with the cable.
But what makes me wonder, though, before he does that, is he said this happened right after he did an update.
So maybe something in that update is affecting
that's
parallel
why,
drivers.
Because trying to find another parallel cable right now is
that's hard too.
Not the easiest thing.
That's very true.
And they usually don't...
Well, try the rollback first.
Actually, we have boxes of parallel cables at our office that... Still new in the box from when parallel printers were common.
Yeah, everything's USB.
Unless you threw them out in the last cleaning.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Oops. Jackie was
all right,
doing some
give
of that,
that
this
but
morning.
Give the what Dave said a try.
And please give us a call back. Let us know how you made out.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem, and we're really getting to the point where I don't know what to say to people anymore. You know,
it's getting hard. I mean, you know,
when you've got dot matrix printers, I don't even know anybody who still makes them for a home.
Yeah,
for a home. I mean, I know they still make them for banks and they still make them for huge printing jobs, but for home use, I don't even know that they make them.
No, you got to buy them used, and because I still use an Epson FX80 for printing my invoices.
What a great printer that was!
Oh, it's
kill it with a club.
I've had that thing since I opened up. I bought it brand new when I opened up the shop back in 88.
Yep,
88. I've had that thing, and it's just a workhorse. All I do is, you know, periodically clean it out, take it outside, hit it with the air hose to blow out all the residue because of the three-part forms.
How do you even still find ribbons for it?
Oh, there's plenty of companies around that I buy, you know, six at a time.
Yeah,
and I keep them in the refrigerator.
Yeah,
yeah, and they work great. Of course, I'm thinking.
Remember, we used to re-ink the ribbons.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember when the trash...
Jim McCollum from the Frog Computer Club not only re-ink his ribbons, but he also had a syringe that he refilled his cartridges for his inkjet printers, too.
Do you remember the old Trash 80 impact printers?
Absolutely.
That they had the hoods.
Yep.
Because they were so loud. You know, I mean... They were soundproofing them because they were so noisy. And you, matter of fact, I remember Kodak, we wound up putting them over in a separate room.
Yep, yep.
And you just print over there and you just say, yeah, let it go ahead and print for a while. It's going to take a while. Not like today, you know, oh, go sell a laser printer and boom, it's right there.
When I started at the bank, I got a tour and one of the guys said, and I bet you've never seen anything like this. And he brought me into a room and they had a giant printer inside a hood. And I said, I have one of those in my home. I'll bring you a picture tomorrow. And I did.
Oops.
Because it's, you know, smaller printer, obviously. Right. But, you know, same idea. Because they were so stinking loud. We used to put them in people's offices, executives' offices, and we had to buy the hoods for them, too.
I used to like the line printers that would print an entire line at a time.
Boom, boom,
and you could,
boom.
If you printed a long document, you could get that thing to fly up a foot or two because it was feeding through so fast.
The problem, and this is what an IBM rep once told me, the problem they eventually had with speed of printing was not how fast they could lay down ink, but how fast they could move paper.
They do not even those
problems
today.
The Bernoulli principle came into effect.
We've got clients inside of Xerox that say the same thing, that the fastest printers today are, 300 pages a minute? And they have to have a partial vacuum inside the printer because air resistance is slowing the paper down.
Yep, that's exactly it. All right, our next caller, well, that's interesting. Our next caller is Paul, who's apparently calling from his car.
Yes, I am, Nick. Good to talk to you again.
You're not driving, are you?
I'm one of your Froggers. No, I'm parked at the Ellwanger house, actually, waiting to go to a jazz thing.
Oh, good for you.
Anyway, I remember back in the days of the dot matrix printers, the other thing that I used to do was a common recommendation at the time was to pop the top on them and carefully spray in WD-40.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
And then wrap them back up with saran wrap or something like that and let them sit for a while.
Yeah.
I used to do them in mass and let them sit for a week.
The reason for that was because the dot matrix printer was essentially a bunch of little pins that popped out and pushed the ink ribbon against the paper to make a dot.
Right.
And unless you used lubricated ink when you re-inked the cartridges or the ribbons, that you would eventually dry out those pins and they would stick.
I never ran across that, but drying out the ribbon was the thing. Once it got dry, then the ink wouldn't transfer.
Right. But even with that, if you didn't use a lubricated ink, you would get stickage.
Tried re-inking. I just tried re-lubricating them.
Yeah. That's a new term?
Yeah, it's
stickage?
Well, sometimes you put...
Is there anybody out there who did not understand what I meant by that? That's really the whole point of communication.
One of the things we used to see is that if you put too much lubricating fluid on it, that then became sort of your ink.
Yeah,
because
sort
it would
of,
stain
yeah.
the paper.
Yeah, it'd make it very messy. So you wanted to be... you didn't want to be generous. You wanted to do a little bit and see how it worked if you wanted... Yep. You figured it out. But I doubt if anybody's going to have enough stuff to do to figure it out anymore.
Yeah, right. Nobody cares anymore. It's just, you know, buying new. Nowadays, laser jet or inkjet printers in particular are under, $50, $100 bucks easy.
Well, yeah, the ink costs you more than the printer.
Yep.
Think about
Lexmark.
Well,
that's just it. Yeah, if you're complaining about the cost of gas, think what a gallon of ink costs.
Yeah, most of those like $10 or $20 ink cartridges, you know, they're 4 or 5 milliliters.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, that's 0.000 some ounces.
Right.
Works out to $3,000 or $4,000 a gallon.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
Yep.
Yep.
I not certainly... too bad Kodak doesn't stay around. There's another ink supplier that won't be around.
Yeah, their big thing they're touting with their printers is the lower ink cost. And printer manufacturers have cut down the cost of the printers themselves. You know, we joke it's the Bic analogy. You give away the printer because you know you're going to sell so much ink. Right. that the printer costs are down so much. And, you know, as we just said, you know, $50 for a printer, and you're going to pay $50 to replace the ink tanks. So you might as well get a new printer every time.
Yep. All righty, well, I'll let you guys go. I got to get off and do some photography.
Go have fun, Paul.
All right. Good talking with you. Take
Good
care.
Talking yep. with you. Have fun.
I believe
I'm actually going to the February meeting of the RCSI, the Rochester Computer Society Incorporated. They asked me if I wanted to come and talk about it's the 20th anniversary, 30th. Wait.
Hmm?
It's the 30th 12. Anniversary of Frog, the start of Frog, Frog Computer Society.
The Apple Cider meeting is this week also.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not going this week. It's February, week.
Yeah.
I think. Is
for the January
doing.
Meetings. Yeah, so this is users group week, isn't it? Where's my calendar? It just sneaks up on us sometimes.
Yep, it's exactly right. It sure does. And the local user groups, we don't talk about them as much as we should, I think.
Yeah, really.
But they really are pretty amazing things. People get together once a month or so. And talk about their computers and help each other out. They have a speaker that comes every month, and there are a bunch of groups in town. There's the general groups like RCSI and Apple Cider. There are specific groups like the Linux group and the App Rochester and a bunch of others. And it's never a bad idea to check them out and see what's going on. Some of them are actually on our calendar, the Soundbites calendar. If anybody from those clubs wants to get on the Soundbites calendar, let me know. We'll be happy to put you there. It's a pretty good thing in there, and they do a lot of nice stuff. The January meeting of RCSI is this coming Tuesday, and RPAD is going to talk about computer processors. So that should be kind of fun. Discuss and clarify the differences among the computers, the CPUs. This is actually part two of a longer talk. They also have SIGs or special interest groups for each of these. For example, there's a Linux SIG and a digital photography SIG and stuff like that. So they're more or less active depending on the one you're looking into. So you should give it a check out and see what those things all have to offer. And in fact, you've got a couple of minutes to do that right now if you're sitting at your computer, because we're going to take a quick break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with more of Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Mina Francesco. I know. And all of you. We'll be back shortly, so don't go away for long, although you can go look up some of that stuff. And we'll be bringing you more of Soundbites right here on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. Well, leave it to the nerds to go huge for the holidays. App downloads spiked during the last week of 2011, peaking at 1.2 billion combined iOS and Android app downloads, according to mobile research firm Flurry Analytics. Moreover, Flurry says it's the biggest week for app downloads in Android and iOS history. Those hungriest for apps live stateside, and U.S. users were responsible for some 500 million downloads, or about 40% of the total downloading fest. China came in a distant second with 99 million users downloads. Flurry's reports come on the heels of a record high for Android and iOS phone activations on Christmas Day, with nearly 7 million new tablets and smartphones activated on that day alone. Flurry estimates that between December 25th through the end of the year, more than 20 million devices were activated across the globe. We can only assume consumers' appetites for apps will grow in 2012. Upwards of 60% of U.S. consumers ages 18 to 24 now own a smartphone. According to Nielsen research data, and among 25 to 34-year-olds, smartphone ownership is still high at over 50%. While hitting more than a billion app downloads in a single week is significant, Fleury estimates this downloading volume will become commonplace as 2012 progresses. Yes, app stores are burgeoning with titles, but Fleury still considers these digital marketplaces relatively immature in their development. As more and more developers flock to create apps, consumer options will increase and app downloads will jump in turn. And, of course, next week, Las Vegas is hosting the annual Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, where all of tech's biggest players announce their premium devices for the coming year. It's expected that Microsoft will give a rundown on its Windows 8 tablet progress. Nokia will make waves in the Windows Phone arena, and sundry manufacturers will continue to introduce new Android-based devices. So what's your favorite app? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
I went to Best Buy this past week and looked at the Kindle Fire.
Yeah.
That is a nice little machine for $200. I mean, it's an Android, so it's running the Android 3.2. So you can download all the apps. And a friend of mine was wondering, well, can I do word processing? Yeah, you can do that. You can get an app that'll do word processing. You know, do up notes.
It's got a browser. Go on to Google Docs.
Yeah, you could. Well, you can go literally anywhere. You know, and she wanted it also for reading books. I said, yeah, and you can check your email. You know, it's a good versatile little tool.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you're traveling around the house and you got wireless, you can stay connected, check on things, browse on stuff, and that. And their only concern was the keyboard. I said, well, you know, I believe you can get keyboards that you can plug into it, like the iPad. But, you know, I mean, the screen isn't bad for that little size. You know, it's a decent-sized keyboard just to still do some typing. You know, if you're doing, like you say, Google Apps and get into word processing or a spreadsheet or whatever. I mean, for $200, I was kind of impressed.
Yeah, it's very hard to beat. I've got, as I've said before, I've got the Nook Color, and then there's the new Nook as well.
How do you like the Nook Color?
I love it. I absolutely
now that's
love
got that's the Android, Android.
That's also Android
3.2.
Yep, and it's very, very nice. I've been very pleased with it so far. I'm waiting for an update to the Kindle Fire. A lot of people are saying it's a little sluggish and it hesitates, and there's a little bit of problems with it that are supposed to be fixed in the next update. So I'm waiting to see that.
Okay.
It's a real nice looking product. It's just apparently there's a few. It's a 1.0 product. What do you expect?
Yeah. You know? One of the big problems that people have found with it is sort of the security that's built in. It's not really designed to be shared with people. So you log into your Amazon account to do things on it to get to your Amazon books and your Amazon videos, and then you hand it to your kid who goes to Amazon Music and buys stuff.
Right.
And it's very, very easy for them to buy things without you knowing it on your Amazon account.
Right.
It's the ease of one-click buying.
That's exactly right. And Barnes and Amazon is very happy to let that happen. I love my Nook Color. My daughter has a Nook Touch. The $79. Well, it's $99 now. It was $79 when I bought it for Christmas. And she reads it constantly. It's 20 odd days of battery life, and it's just a reader. But
it's got the nice screen on it. So if you're even out in bright sunlight, it doesn't matter.
And it's really what she wants, because she's got an iPod Touch. Mm-hmm. She's got an Android phone. She really doesn't need a third device that does all that stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of
you know. So for in this case $79, even $99, it's certainly a great little reader. Barnes & Noble's having some trouble right now. We don't know if Barnes & Noble's going to be around.
There was rumors that we're going to spin off the Nook business.
Yeah, which is kind of, I think, stupid, right? Because that's really what's keeping the company afloat at this moment. So who knows? But I do love my Nook. I love the ease of buying books. The Kindle works very much the same way. To me, the Kindle feels flimsier, but I haven't seen the new generation. I haven't played with the new generation enough to really, get a feel for it. But and you said they're at Best Buy?
Yeah.
So I might have to go look at it. I just haven't had a time.
I went over there, and of course, I love always looking at the new toys and that type of stuff, play around with it. Because there you can touch the different stuff in there.
Right.
And that's why we tell folks, even with laptops, you know, before going out, go out and test drive some of them. Because the laptops, you know, the way the keyboards are laid out and the response to the keys and everything else, some folks like a mushy keyboard, some like ones that'll click. You know, I mean, there's quite a variety.
Yep.
And, you know, just the screen layouts and everything else.
There's an interesting comparison from Huffington Post on the Nook versus the Kindle Fire. And they say the Nook has a better display. The Kindle Fire comes with more storage than the Nook does.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, no, yeah. Kindle has 8 gig storage. The Nook is 16.
But I believe with the Fire, though, you can add an SD card.
No, you can. You can in the on the Nook.
On the Nook, you can. The Kindle, you can't.
I thought the SD.
Nope.
Okay.
So the
I was looking at too many of them.
Yeah.
Kindle has better software. Nook has better hardware. So it's interesting that, you know, between them, they're a really good machine.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem. And of course, now we're seeing a lot of upstarts coming along. There's a company in India that's making a $35 Android tablet, and they say it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
For $35,
mm-hmm.
right? And of course, you can get a Kindle app or
even the straight Kindle Nook readers, app. the Nook the regular book readers from Nook and Kindle start at $79 for just books, and the e-ink display that it uses is often easier to read a book on than the LCD display that tablets use.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I'm a little jealous of my daughter's
If all you want is a book reader,
right?
But then you move up to the tablets and they do a little more. Then you move up to the bigger screen tablets, they do a little more.
Well, but again, if I've already got a smartphone and I've already got a Chromebook and I've already got an Android tablet.
Well, you're a computer geek.
Why? Right. But the point is, you know, how many, if you only have one, then you're going to get one. But, but most people have at least two devices.
We had a customer the other day that was she doesn't want to trade in her old phone yet. She's using an old BlackBerry until the tablets can do everything, because she wants one device to do everything. And you can sort of do that with the Nook or Kindle tablets or the iPad. It's got all the tablet stuff. It's got all the movie stuff and music stuff.
But they don't have all that stuff because none of them have cameras. And none of them make phone calls.
Yeah, the iPad, when you move up into the higher end, the iPad has a camera. You can use the Skype app for Android or for iPad to make computer-to-computer calls for free.
Right.
And Skype will make telephone calls for an added price.
Right.
So we're almost there.
Right.
And I sort of get her point. She wants one device to do everything rather than carrying a phone and a music player and a web browser and a tablet.
Right, and I've said this before. Yeah. I'm not sure that I want a 10-inch tablet to carry around that does everything.
Yeah,
but
it's a
7-inch is fine. And if it also did phone and I could just stick a USB device in my ear and make phone calls that way. There's a company that makes a wristwatch that tells you who's calling. It's a USB wristwatch to connect to your Android device, and you can see who's calling and pick up the call from your watch to your headset, to your earpiece, your USB earpiece.
That's the sort of thing we'll see at CES next week, too, is all these cool little gadgets that might ship by Christmas.
Well, right. CES is the stuff comes out in January. You might see it by Christmas. But we'll be talking about CES. Oddly, Jazz 90.1 has not seen fit to send us to the CES show this year. I'm shocked by that. Shocked, I say. But we'll still be reporting what we find out as we go along and see what new gadgets are out there. Right now, it looks like the year of the tablet device. But we'll see. I'm wondering if Google will make their Chrome push this year. We'll see. Could be an interesting year. Anyway, that's all in the future. Right now, at this precise moment, we are done for another week of Soundbites. I want to thank each and every one of you who called in. I want to thank those of you who didn't call in but were listening. And those of you who weren't listening, I have rude things to say to you, but you wouldn't hear them anyway because you're not listening, so who cares? So we want to thank you for Dave Enright, for Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. You have been listening to us here on Soundbites. Please become our friends on Facebook and on Google Plus, and follow us on Twitter and all the other things that we have. You can find links to all those things on our website. And we will see you back here next week for yet another edition of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.